as their fellow Dems, but when the time comes, they vote on our behalf to deregulate and privatize and outsource and downsize. One such Democratic hero to the billionaire cause was Senator Max Baucus. As a leading recipient of money from our health insurance companies, Max was the only thing that stood between our continued huge profits and the nightmare of real, comprehensive, universal health care in America. And they don't call Joseph Lieberman the senator from Aetna for nothing. Although it's nice to keep a small collection of Democratic congressmen amid our much larger one of Republicans, when push comes to shove, we gravitate toward the Republican brand because the Democratic base is so pro-union. And even our own billionaire-friendly Democrats are forced to pay lip service to an anti-corporate message from time to time. The Republican base is mostly social conservatives, and they don't seem to have any objection with voting against their financial self-interest for guys who will further ours, so we're writing our biggest checks to Republicans. And if the Democrats in our collection get shellacked this year, they can count on a nice, fat sinecure with us as corporate lobbyists next year. This has been Felonious Acts of the Billionaires, reporting from Charlotte.
If you really want to fight in the war, if you like the way we're treating the poor, if you don't care about education,
hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote.
You've been listening to a special election edition of Earthwatch on WBAI New York, or possibly WBAI.org, featuring certain developments of controversy earlier this evening at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm Robert Knight in New York, inviting you to stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
And that program was brought to you live with portions on recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Another one in our series of interviews from this year's Nebula Awards weekend, where I conducted about, a dozen or so, and this one, great writer, Joe Haldeman. Stay tuned. again, good morning. So this is Hour of the Wolf for, well, technically it's Thursday, so it's September 6th. It's always one of those which is it kind of things, because to me, it's Wednesday. You know, I got up, it was Wednesday afternoon, I'm doing a show tonight, but it's after midnight that makes it Thursday morning, unless I have a guest on the phone, in which case it's, well, whatever time it is there. Next week, I hope to have a guest on from California, and so it'll be Wednesday night for that person, certainly. So, and I should explain that. Some months ago, I did an interview with yet another one of the greats in science fiction, John Shirley, and I was waiting for a while to put it on so I could get a reading. He did a reading in May at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and the reading he did was absolutely wonderful, and without any changes in Pacifica policy, also unbroadcastable. Although, actually, since we're in what they call safe harbor now, I ought to talk to the program director about that and see if Pacifica policy may perhaps change. Since certainly the FCC policy has changed, perhaps Pacifica programming policy will change. I wouldn't hold my breath, but it hopefully can't hurt to ask. At any rate, I recorded an interview with John as well at that time, and he's been writing me, asking me why I haven't yet broadcast it. And I've been writing him back and getting no response. Apparently, there's some kind of technical glitch. I've been getting his emails. He hasn't been getting mine. I used a different account than he got mine, so we're in touch again. And I said, listen, within 2 weeks, I'll be sure to put it on. And now I can't find the interview for other technological reasons. John doesn't know this yet, unless, of course, he's listening to this show, and I'm sure somebody will tip him off. So I'm going to call him or write him and see if we can have him on live. If I cannot do that for next week, and if I do not find that, so next week should be John Shirley. If I do not find that, well, tomorrow afternoon, thanks to Tor Books, I'm going to be recording an interview with a couple of writers you may have heard of, Cory Doctorow and Charles Strauss, either one of whom could easily get, you know, a 2 or 5 hour show. But we'll be recording about a 90-minute interview tomorrow, and or maybe even a little longer, and break it up into two shows. That might be a good idea. We'll have to see how that works out. But I'm actually, Tor has actually sandwiched me, get this, between, before me, they're over at Google doing one of Google's little TED-like seminars. And after that, when I'm done recording those two guys, the New York Times is going to be interviewing them. So it's like, okay, fine. At any rate, I have nothing to complain about since August, since we came back from our last July long thon. We have had, I am proud to boast, great show after great show. In order, Daniel Jose Older came in and read from his new collection of stories, his first collection of stories, and new one, A Salsa Nocturna. And he's doing, by the way, another performance of stuff from that work at the New Yorican Cafe. I went to the first one. It was a sellout, and it was wonderful. And he and I are talking about doing some other production, studio production on that, which was very cool. And this is just, you know, a great new voice in science fiction fantasy. So I was very, very proud and pleased to present that. He's also really, really good jazz composer and performer. Then, the week after that, Norman Spinrad. The week after that was Harlan Ellison. than Connie Willis, and last week, Michael Bishop. And the hits just keep coming. Some of these were live. Some of these were on the phone. I tend not to do phone interviews. I don't like them. The problem with phone interviews and an interview like the one that we're going to hear this morning is they don't include readings. Now, we did do short fiction last week with Michael Bishop live on the phone. And by the way, I'm curious. You can call me up as we hear the Joe Haldeman interview. How anybody who heard last week's show, how you think that went. I am generally unhappy with the idea of reading fiction on the phone. What I'm going to try to do with John Shirley for a reading that is broadcastable also, is he lives in San Francisco. So I'm going to see if I can get him over to our sister station, KPFA, and have him record there, have it sent here, and then we'll have studio quality. But we're going to work that out. So I'm just mentioning all this because, well, gee, I'm darned proud over the programs we've had in the last few weeks. Coming up besides Charles Stross and Cory Doctorow. Aside from that is Mary Robinette Kowal, which is another Nebula interview. And we have some interesting live possibilities as well. Also, an event in person, live, in front of your very face. If you, wonder what that's about. If you care to show up next Tuesday, and if you'd like to have fiction read to you, well, then, here's a wonderful opportunity. Rick Bose, Richard Bose, and Carlos Hernandez will be reading for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is a monthly event that I produce. Usually it's once a month, but in September, we're doing two readings. The next one will be because Roz Kaveni is coming in. Actually, she's coming in from Seattle, but she's from London and is a fascinating, charismatic poison. And also Deborah Grabian, who basically turns, among other things that she writes, the Kincaid Chronicles and various things, she also takes stories from child ballads and turns them into murder mysteries, which is, you know, Mattie Groves and all that. And it's absolutely wonderful stuff. And so we know that's also going to be having something to do with what we have on the air end of September. So anyhow, that's September 27th. And that's actually opposite another science fiction reading at Blue Stockings. The problem being, we usually go on Tuesdays. Only it was pointed out to me that the Tuesday of that week is Yom Kippur. And while I am not an extremely observant Jew, Yom Kippur is a very, very special day, especially as I am the product of two Holocaust survivors. And as such, I will respect the holiday to the extent of certainly not holding what amounts to a party on that day. So we moved it to Thursday only to discover that Jen Brissett, who has the Kindred reading series, which is this wonderful new reading series that I'll tell you more about as we approach that date. Yes, I will promote the competition. It's not a competition. It's just this one time. We're both equally upset over competing for time, as it were. So I'll promote both. Anyway, there's still one, nevertheless, this coming Tuesday. Oh, darn, I'm kicking myself. Our station manager, Berthold Reimer, was here till minutes, 45 minutes ago, and I had an idea for this next reading that would help benefit WBAI, and I could have spoken to him about it, and I failed to do so. I'm going to have to call him tomorrow. Actually, I'm coming here for a program, for programming meeting tomorrow for the next fundraising drive. It's too early. It's too early. But anyway, Rick Bowes, and he's actually the reason for this fundraising opportunity. A year ago, on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, read for us, rebroadcast his reading of his incredible short story, There's a Hole in the City, which is still the best piece of fiction about September 11th and the aftermath that I have ever read. But it is only a coincidence that this reading is September 11th. Normally, it would have been, in fact, yesterday, Tuesday. But I didn't want to compete, A, with Labor Day weekend, and B, with the World Science Fiction Convention, which occurs over Labor Day weekend. So we're moved to next Tuesday. The date is September 11th. Okay, get over it. Carlos Hernandez is a relatively new voice in science fiction. He will be one of the two readers. He features his Cuban roots in his writing, except when he doesn't. I'm reading his bio, which he sent me. You can find his fiction in places like Beware the Night, You Don't Have a Clue, Interfictions 2, Interzone, Futurismic, and Fiction International. But if your karma is good, his work will find you. By day, Carlos is a CUNY professor of English. He is also lead writer for Merryweather, a computer role-playing game chronicling the Lewis and Clark expedition. I should mention, by the way, this must be CUNY Professor Month for the New York City Readings, because our host for the reading on September 27th will be Professor Veronica Shanus, also a CUNY professor. Okay. And the aforementioned Rick Bowes. Richard Bowes lives in Manhattan, has published 5 novels, 2 collections, and 60 stories. His mosaic novel, Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, will be published next year by Leith Press. Leith will also reprint his Lambda winning novel, Minions of the Moon, in late 2012. Recent and forthcoming appearances include the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, Icarus, Apex, Lightspeed, and the anthologies Million Writers Award, After Wild Stories, 2012. That's wild as an Oscar. Bloody Fabulous, Ghosts, Recent Hauntings, Handsome Devil, and Hauntings. So, that's this coming Tuesday, September 11th. Admission is free. Doors open at 6:30. While admission is free, we do suggest a donation on your way in to help cover costs. And I've acquired all new equipment to record these things. So, that I'm going to pay for. But we'd like to, you know, pay the writers and things like that, so donations really are appreciated. This all occurs at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is 138 Sullivan Street. That's on Sullivan between Prince and Houston. So 138 Sullivan Street next September 11th. The event begins around 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. Show up early, and we have cheese and cider and reception for the writers, and it is all free, donations accepted, etc., etc., etc. For more information, either send me an email and I'll put you on the mailing list, and it would, my email address is jim@ourwolf.com. Jim is J-I-M, ourwolf is H-O-U-R W-O-L-F, like the title of this show, Hour of the Wolf. It's ourwolf.com. And or I should say, you can look it up on Facebook. Look up the NYRSF Readings, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, but we abbreviate that, NYRSF, N-Y-R-S-F, which is one of the best magazines about science fiction out there. And the reading series is not directly affiliated, but named after that series. And we maintain a kissing cousin kind of relationship with them. At least we admire who they are and what they do, and as long as they don't have a problem with our using their name, we'll continue to do so. So look that up, Nursef Readings on Facebook, and join the group, and you'll get notices that way as well, and more information. Okay. Joe Haldeman. Okay, you know, all this stuff in front of me, and I really, you know, I didn't bring up Joe's bio. It's and I really should do this. Let me see if I can use my little Nexus here. And let's try it this way. You can even do it on the air. And let's say, Google. I'm doing it. It's not responding. Google. Who is Joe Haldeman? Okay, it actually gave me a list of links. It didn't respond. It sometimes actually responds by voice, but you heard all the cute little things. Okay, and yeah, selected bibliography is all that I need right now. His best known work is, without question, The Forever War, which won the Nebula Award in 1975. If you make the mistake of reading only one book by Joe Haldeman, it would be The Forever War. Inevitably, somebody will make a movie of it. In a way, there are any number of aspects in which that movie has been made, or at least things have been taken from it. A certain amount of James Cameron's Aliens, I think, uses some of Joe Haldeman's, a cross between Joe Haldeman and Robert Heinlein's concept of what space marines would be. And Joe was a marine, and he is a pacifist, and or at least anti-war. In fact, he has a brilliant anthology that he edited called Study War No More. Among his other books are War Year, Mind Bridge, that was his second novel, as I recall, All My Sins Remembered. He's written a couple of Star Trek novels, but don't hold that against him. The Hemingway Hoax, in fact, the fellow who owns the gallery where we hold the reading series was the editor of the Star Trek books. He was a former president of the Science Fiction Writers of America, the organization that was where we recorded the interview that you are about to hear, if I ever shut up. It is. Well, we'll talk about it in there. Ridley Scott has optioned The Forever War, and I think he still owns the option on that. He did write one, well, terrible movie called Robot Jocks, J-O-X, which came out in 1990. According to Wikipedia, it quotes him as saying, to me, it's as if I had a child who started out well and then sustained brain damage. What can I say? We don't so much. Joe had been a regular guest on Hour of the Wolf and then became a little more remote. We just haven't run into each other as much, partly because I don't go to as many conventions as I used to. I did not, for example, go to Chicago for the World Science Fiction Convention this year. I will, however, be going to Toronto for the World Fantasy Convention. One can only do so many. And I expect to be at the New York Comic Con as well. At any rate, I'm trying to give you just a little bit of background as we get to the interview, because it's, call the interview a cold interview. We just sort of came in. It was the morning after the Nebula Awards. Everybody was up real late enjoying themselves, partying, certainly Joe and I among them. And then the following morning at 11 a.m., We then got together and recorded this, and you're going to hear it more or less unedited. I've cut out about the first 5 minutes because I was listening to that while I was sitting here during Robert's show and realizing, okay, there's a lot of chit-chat that people don't need, and there may still be some left, but sit and suffer. This is not what you call an in-depth interview. It is a chat with one of the great writers of science fiction. Having said that, set your way back machine for May 20th of 2012 at 11 a.m. and join Joe Haldeman and I, already in progress.
These years, I have to get you back on the air live.
Yeah, I'd like to.
Yeah. I remember one particular time.
Yeah.
It was the 70s, mm-hmm. where you were reading. WBAI was located at a church.
That dark little basement studio?
No.
No, that's a different one. Okay.
No. We had an entire large building in Manhattan. On 62nd Street and 1st Avenue. We had three floors. And no, we were wide open and visible to the street, and we had we had a studio that sat about 400 people for 300 people for concerts and things like that. And we were in the sanctuary of the church. And in what had been the rectory across was a different religion had moved in there, calling itself the Foundation.
Ah, yes.
And they had started a science fiction reading series.
Yeah.
And I actually had the ability, if I wanted to record, and they very much wanted to be on our radio, to simply go into this tiny little church courtyard past our boiler room, and I could go through there. And upstairs, only we discovered that in that little courtyard, they had chickens.
Oh.
And we're doing what seemed like a nice reading series, and they started with Harlan Ellison and Isaac Asimov, and I think you were the second week.
Yeah. Huh.
And I don't remember who else was there about that time. They didn't keep it up for very long, and in fact, they didn't exist for very long.
Yeah.
Do you recall why?
No.
We were at WBAI. We're trying to figure out exactly who they were. They wouldn't give a denomination. They wouldn't give it. And they're saying, oh, well, we're something both old and new. We did notice, though, that on about once a month, there would generally be one less rooster or chicken in that yard. Hmm. And indeed, our worst fears were confirmed. It wasn't that they had a geek on hand, but it was about as bad. They were a splinter group of an organization called The Process.
Yeah.
And the process itself may not have been totally evil, but a different splinter group of the process was the family. That's Charles Manson.
Charles Manson's.
So those people for whom you were reading, little did we know,
would be famous.
Were cousins, basically, to the Manson family.
Wow.
And at a certain point, Margot Adler, who was my co-producer at the time and now is one of the people who runs this thing called NPR.
Mm-hmm.
Margot was looking into it and got down to the facts that and she's a Wiccan.
Yeah.
They were very interested in talking to her. They had no problem with that, even though they were some kind of Christian thing. And they were Christian, very Christian. They were Satanists.
Yeah.
They believed, they said, well, Jesus said, love thy enemy. Satan was Jesus' enemy, therefore, love Satan. I mean, it was like a Polanski film.
Yeah.
And I have the tape of you reading.
Wow. Is that All My Sins Remembered? Or?
Ooh, I don't recall, but I will find out, because those tapes are 10-inch reel-to-reel tapes, oxide tape.
Yeah.
And if they are on Mylar, they're probably good for another 10 or 20 years. But if they have acetate backing, they're good for one play.
Right.
I'll be able to play it once, and every 10 minutes or so, clean the heads, because the oxide is going to come right off.
Yeah.
So I have to... I have thousands of hours of tapes. I have all of Baird Searles' collection, if you remember him. And before him, a music director at Pacifica Radio, Anthony Boucher. I've got his tapes, so I've got to be digitizing this stuff.
Yeah, really. Carefully.
Yeah. So, yeah, very carefully. So it needs a grant. It needs an archivist, which probably needs a grant. So what have you written since then? But we do have a lot of listeners who no doubt will know, first and foremost, I guess, the Forever War.
Yep.
Which probably will go down in history as one of the great greats of all time.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Well, I shouldn't ask
suppose.
You. Let me, no, let me tell listeners.
Yeah.
It will be remembered, aside from Mind Bridge and All My Sins Remembered and all the other books. Did I get them in order?
Close, yeah.
Okay. As among the greats, and then, of course, Forever Peace and other things. It's been so long. Some wonderful short stories.
Well, a few of them I write. It looks like I write about one book of short stories for every four novels. So that's one book of short stories a decade, approximately, or every 8 years.
Yeah, that's not bad, especially also when you consider the financial return somehow just isn't the same.
No, it's negligible for short stories.
Yeah.
Well, usually. I mean, you can hit Playboy every now and then and so forth.
But and we should rephrase it. You can hit Playboy every now and then. Not
why even?
Not that many writers get in there.
I have been paid by Playboy one more time than I've been published. Oddly enough.
Really?
Yeah, I wrote a story called Graves, and the fiction editor at Playboy, Alice, loved the story, but her associate editor or managing editor said it was too gruesome. It has maggots and things like that. So, you know, you don't think about maggots when you think about Playboy. So Alice...
They tend not to. They don't make... They're not very photogenic.
So this is Alice Turner. She waited a year. She asked me whether she could wait a year and send it up again to see whether it would get by him. And he actually said, Alice, what are you trying here? I mean, when I rejected this story, I rejected it for good.
Ah.
But, in fact, then I sent it over to FNSF. And it subsequently won the World Fantasy Award for the best short story of the year. So Alice and I were right. And that nameless person who kept rejecting it is now lost in the mists of time.
As befitting.
Yes.
Somebody who would reject a story like that.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing to add. Well, do you have any other favorite rejection stories?
You know, I don't really have much rejection in my history. I've been an extremely lucky writer.
Yeah.
I've got one that's just so bizarre, just a single story. And I'm trying to remember the name of it, because I changed the name of it and such. There was a fellow who went streaking through science fiction in the early 70s. Roger Elwood.
Oh.
And he brought out, I don't know, must have been 40 anthologies in 2 years. And he was just buying stories left and right and left and right. Well, I wrote this one story in response to his request for a story. And he sent it back with some you know, dismissive comment. And so I tried it on another, on a magazine, and then another magazine. Nobody wanted it. And in fact, each magazine sent it back with a suggestion for changes. And so I would try to put that in there, and then they'd send it back again. So this thing had been rewritten to so many different people's tastes that it was almost incomprehensible. But then Roger Elwood had a little statement of who he published and so forth in the writer's yearbook, and he included my name in his list of authors. So I sent him this story, and I said, Roger, you claim to have published something by mine, and you have not, but here's your chance. And it wound up in a collection called And Now Walk Gently Through the Fire and Other Stories by Ray Lafferty. And in fact, it had that one story by Ray Lafferty and then a bunch of other stories by nobodies like me.
Yeah. He was a strange, peculiar,
weird dude.
Phenomenon.
Well, he went from science fiction. He left us just like a stricken bridegroom. He left us for wrestling magazines.
Wrestling?
And he believed, he didn't know that wrestling was fake. That was the bizarre thing. I mean, he's a very strange person.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure he's still a strange person. We can't be sued for saying somebody's strange.
Is he still around?
I don't know. I don't know where he went to after wrestling magazines.
Yeah. Where does one go to after wrestling magazines?
It's kind of the bottom of the barrel.
Well, circus magazines, I suppose.
Yeah,
it's
right.
A similar kind of thing. I knew a wrestler. I didn't know that much about him. I know nothing about wrestling, but I was working at a talent agency as a residuals clerk. This very, very nice guy would come in, sit down. He liked actually talking science fiction and stuff.
Yeah.
Very intelligent and all that. And we were handling him for commercials.
Yeah.
And things like that. And I asked, you know, we don't seem to be doing any movies or anything for you. He said, oh, one of these years I may do that after I can't wrestle anymore.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean wrestling? He said, I'm a professional wrestler. I said, what do you mean? He was a wrestler. And I mentioned this to a friend of mine who I thought was otherwise intelligent, was totally into wrestling.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, blah, blah, blah. He was incredulous.
Wow.
That I would know this person. But this person, we had lunch one day, and he told me how they rehearsed. And they didn't rehearse much. They just made sure nobody could get hurt.
Yeah.
But they had to know the arc.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, first you're going to lose this match, then there's going to be a rematch in which this one gets you. And we need to create the archetype, and they're actually talking, he said...
Like a narrative, yeah.
Yeah, it is a narrative. And he said that some of the people involved were experts in Jung.
He really?
And that they were trying to follow Jungian archetypes in determining the season of a wrestling match. And I began to see why, not me, but maybe some other people.
Yeah, would like that.
Yeah. But that story about, I'm sorry, it's just the Roger Elwood thing sparked off some strange synapses in my mind. What have, for listeners who have heard you, the last time you were on, what have you been busy with in the last...
30 years?
I was going to say more like 10.
Oh, 10 years, well...
Yeah, it's easier. For me.
For the past 10 years, I've mostly been involved in the trilogy that starts with Mars Bound. This is an odd thing, because Mars Bound was a one-shot novelette for a collection of YA stories, which the editor wanted to make reminiscent of the old Heinlein juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just good adventure stories with strong narrative and with good science, solid real science and so forth. So I said sure, but I was thinking in the back of my mind, well, here's my chance to write a YA novel. So I'd write a novelette which I could expand into a novel, and I didn't have any YAs. It's a market I've never hit. But what happened was I wrote the novelette, and I expanded into a novel, but it wasn't a juvenile. It's just a plain science fiction novel. And I remember this so well because I was finishing the novel, going on the train from Florida up to New York City. And when we were about an hour from New York, I was down to the last 10 or so pages of this novel. And I thought, holy shit, I've got to do a sequel to this. And while I was in New York, I had a layover of about 4 hours in Grand Central. So I went over to this little beer joint across from Grand Central, the steakhouse. And I sat there and I started typing up an outline for the sequel to Earthbound, to Marsbound. And then I realized that there had to be a sequel to that. In other words, I had a whole trilogy, which started out as an assignment to do a short story. And really, that took the most of the last decade, because those three novels took 5 years to write.
Wow.
And I think they make a tight, an actual honest trilogy.
I think they work that way.
And yeah. I'm not a trilogy writer. I mean, a lot of writers do automatically go into that, but...
And a lot of publishers, I assume, like
that. Oh, they
that,
like
that,
them,
yeah.
Because, yeah. Each novel in the trilogy is an advertisement for the other two, so it's basically free publicity. But
it'd be
I
nice
never
if they kept book
that.
One in print when book three comes out.
Yeah, so. That's good if you can get it. But now I have committed trilogy otherwise, too, so I can't claim myself being a non-trilogist or a unitary novelist, because the Forever War and Forever Free make a set, and Forever Peace is sort of an over. It's a novel that doesn't involve the same characters, but involves the same ideas.
Right.
And is obviously related to the other two. So, trilogies, hey, the way to go.
Yeah. Now, as long as you've mentioned Forever War, mm-hmm. I am always hearing rumors, sometimes reports, but reports don't always seem to be well-founded, that the movie will get made.
Well, you never know. As the old saying goes, the way they treat writers and in Hollywood, it's the way they treat mushrooms and keep them in the dark and feed them bullshit. And so I've basically been in that situation for a long time. The thing is, a movie, even as a free-floating identity, generates money just as part of its metabolism.
Mm-hmm. Just by being optioned.
Yeah, yeah. And I think probably over the 30-year life of the Forever War, it has probably directly or indirectly made about a quarter of my income.
Wow.
And I've written like 30 other books.
Yeah.
But it just is a gift that keeps on giving. But, you know, it was the one natural novel for me to write, because I'm a science fiction guy. I was a science fiction guy before I was drafted. Well, before I went to college. When I graduated from college and was going to be a writer, science fiction was what I was going to write. But then when I got drafted, I got the one big story to write, which, you know, everybody who's a writer and a soldier has to write a novel about being a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you're sort of wasting a lot of material. And so I wrote a mainstream novel, Warrior, about Vietnam, and then sort of waited. I wrote a couple other books before the necessity for writing The Forever War appeared, because I didn't say, oh, I'm ready to write a Vietnam novel in science fiction mode. I guess I've told this story before, but I just sat down. We were visiting Keith Lohmer down in Florida, and he and my wife, Gay, went down to the grocery store, which is like 25 miles away, so it was a big deal to go get groceries. But I sat at his dining room table and put up my little typewriter, and I typed out, tonight we're going to show you eight silent ways to kill a man.
Uh-huh.
And that was a line that I had heard in basic training, which I thought was, oh God, so corny, but it doesn't leave your mind.
No.
So I just typed that out and then continued the narrative from that line in a science fictional context. And really, 7 or 8 pages on, I saw the story developing. And then before long, I realized it was going to be a novel, and it was going to be my first science fiction novel. I started another science fiction novel, which eventually saw the light of day as Star School. With my brother collaborating. But I had started that before the Forever War, and I showed it to my editor at Holt Reinhardt and Winston, who had done my mainstream novel, War Year. And she said, "Oh, don't do this. This is just a horrible idea. You know, throw it away." And I thought, well, she knows the business, and so I didn't throw it away, but I put it at the bottom of the stack. What I didn't realize was that was my first novel, but it was her first novel as an editor, too. So she didn't know what she was talking about. And basically, the whole story is, years and years later, what, 15 or 20 years later, my brother said, "Do you still have that outline for the novel about the kid mm-hmm. in the future going to school?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Why don't we collaborate on it? Why don't you give it to me and I'll see what I can do?" And basically we did that. We alternated chapters. I had the odd-numbered ones and he had the even-numbered ones. And at that time, I was living on the coast of Florida in Ormond Beach, and he was living in the middle in Gainesville. And we mailed chapters back and forth. We put them on the bus.
For those Oh my God. Yeah. For those people listening who remember mail. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
When it wasn't just for your circulars.
Right. It's interesting. Interesting future we have here, Ferkel. But yeah, no, actually, come to think of it, he wasn't in Gainesville. He was over on the west coast of Florida, up by Brooksville. Mm-hmm. And so it was a long way for the manuscript to go. And basically, we just hacked away at it for several years in our spare time and wound up with this very, very strange novel. It's obviously two voices yelling back and forth mm-hmm. across the great peninsula of Florida, the penis of the United States.
But that was also a wonderful era for experimental writing within science
yeah.
fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Where there were all kinds of stunts and tricks being pulled. We're not talking about the new wave here. We're just talking about somebody writing a first chapter of a book and then having five other writers write the complete rest of the book.
You know, exactly. One thing that occurs to me in that regard was Keith Laumer wrote, and Keith Laumer is not a great experimental writer, you know. He's just kind of a hack writer. But he had this idea he and Gordy Dixon and Harry Harrison, and I think Brian Aldiss. It was five authors together. Keith had pounded out the first page for a story, and he sent it to all of them and said, "Okay, now, without any consultation, everybody write a novelette."
I can't think of the.
It's called Five Fates.
Right.
Five Fates.
Right. I can see the cover.
Yeah.
Couldn't remember the name, but I could see the cover in my head.
But that was back when Doubleday would do a hardcover of any cockamamie science fiction story if the names were recognizable.
Yeah. Yeah. And they get the library sales.
Right.
And the standing store sales.
Yeah.
And they pulp it the next week.
Exactly. And they, you know, everybody makes a little money, nobody makes a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember a whole guest of honor speech, you were there, by George Alec Effinger at a Flange in Pittsburgh. On just that topic.
Yeah.
Somebody,
it may have been Keith, had a novel pulped by accident because the title sounded like one that they were pulping, and it came right off the printing press straight into the pulp mill. Nobody ever saw a copy of it.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's a sad story. Yeah, yeah. And we should mention to listeners, by the way, that when you say that he was a hack, that doesn't mean he wasn't so readable.
Oh, he was a good writer.
He was absolutely readable. I have friends here in Washington in the diplomatic service who, you know, they want a plaque to him.
Oh, yeah.
In the Department of State.
He really did stuff for the diplomatic corps. But in fact, he was a natural born storyteller.
Yeah.
And he couldn't really write badly.
Yeah.
He didn't try anything experimental, really. He didn't push the envelope, but he filled the envelope very well. And he was, you know, he's the most businesslike. guy. We were talking this morning about him over breakfast because he would he was an architect by training. And he made himself this wonderful Frank Lloyd Wright type building with all this strange flying buttresses and things on an island which his father had given him. His father was a millionaire. He's one of the biggest real estate developers in Florida.
Hmm.
So his father had given him this island. And he built this wonderful fantasy mansion that had one wing that jutted out north-south. And he would go there and write on different colors of paper. You know, pink for the first draft, yellow for the second draft, white for the final draft. And so he'd write on a manual typewriter, really as fast as a secretary could do stenography, do, you know, typing letters. And it was kind of remarkable because he'd make a stack of 33 and a third RPM records, all classical. And his record player would hold about 10 or 12. Mm. And so he'd make a big stack of them and a pot of coffee. And he'd go into his lair and just write for like 2 hours while the records cycled through. And then he'd quit and do other stuff. He had stocked his big lake with bass. And so he enjoyed fishing. You know, which was like shooting fish in a barrel because there were so many of them.
Mm.
But he actually had, more so than most people I've known, he had outlined what he wanted out of his life. And then he proceeded to do it. I mean, just plain do it. The devil take the hindmost. It does not make for stable marriages, for one thing,
mm-hmm.
or stable friendships either. So Keith, you know, he had a lot of people who had come up through science fiction with him. And we were sort of his hardcore friends. But he didn't make social friends very well or at all. He couldn't hold on to women to save his life, including his wife. And his family didn't much care for him either.
Mm-hmm.
But ruthless. Ruthless intelligence and ruthless drive to be successful. I think if he had any failings that you could pin down easily, it was sort of he set his sights too low. As I say, he wouldn't do experimental writing, but he didn't see writing as an art in the way that most writers do. He saw it as a craft that he could do very well and made fun of anybody who had higher aspirations.
Mm. I'm now remembering some of the stuff in the backs of the magazines about that. Who were some of your favorite collaborators?
I haven't collaborated on...
Not in years.
No. No, I mean, by my nature, I don't do it well. I mean, I sort of enjoyed collaborating with my brother.
Yeah.
Because we saw this...
That's what I remember, of course.
Well, that's more a family thing than a literary thing, because he needed to make money.
We should tell listeners, called Jay, but the byline was Jack C.
Jack C. Haldeman II. And he made me call myself Joe Haldeman rather than Joe W. Haldeman. So he would take the middle initial so that we wouldn't be confused in people's minds, which makes sense, I guess. But he was very serious about writing, but he also did the most shameless commercial crap. I mean, really, the science fiction equivalent of wrestling magazines. But he didn't, you know, I respect that he could do both. Mm-hmm. You know, and he needed to make the money. Because I had a wife who was employable and not unwilling to work, I could do what I wanted at my own rate. And, well, we actually had a deal when I got out of graduate school. When I dropped out of graduate school, we would go for 2 years while I wrote, and she taught high school. And if at the end of 2 years I was not making enough money to call myself a serious writer, then I would get a job. And so at the end of 2 years, actually, the Forever War was almost finished, and I was making magazine sales all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
That was a wonderful time in retrospect, because I had two novels going and a series of short stories. I get up in the morning and take a shower and just sort through my mind and figure out what I wanted to write that day.
Mm.
And then I'd, you know, drink my orange juice and make my coffee and sit down and just go. And for a while I was writing 1,000 words a day, hell or high water. And sometimes I would write 1,000 words in like 2 hours. And some days I would be going all the way till 10 or 11 o'clock at night before I finally got 1,000 words. And I'd be counting them, you know. There's 383 words on this page. And, you know...
Word processes are good for that.
Yeah, yeah. But that's also... It was pretty obvious that that was too much work for me to do. That I couldn't keep doing that for the rest of my life, or I had a very short life. And I've seen this now, that there are writers who can just sit and crank it out and enjoy it. And... Some of them have careers that last more than half a century. Some of them do burn out real quick. And it doesn't have anything to do with how serious they are in normal literary terms, you know. Because writing is, I think the word serious should be interpreted in more than one way. I think a person who writes absolute crap, but that crap is his only source of income for his whole family, that's about as serious as anybody's work.
Yeah.
You know, and it shouldn't be belittled just because it doesn't have, you know, big ambitions.
Yeah.
And as we know, you know, I mean, what do you call... I'm rereading Boswell. Talk about a hack, you know?
Yeah.
Scratch, 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 scratch. I think it
was Boswell, I think, who said that everybody must write 100 words a day, no matter what you're doing. Whatever's going on in your life, write 100 words a day.
Well, he certainly did that the first hour. But his great anecdote was in his Life of Johnson. Or when he was writing about writing his Life of Johnson, he came into the Cheddar Cheese or whichever, Cheshire Cheese or whatever pub Johnson was in, and he was finishing up his daily thing for the Tattler or whatever. And Boswell says, oh, can I read it before you send it over? And Johnson is putting sand on it, you know, to dry the ink. And he blows the sand off and folds it in two. And he says, if I don't get to read it a second time, you don't get to read it a first time. Yeah. So, yeah, they were great hacks.
Yeah. Now, we only have about 10 minutes left, okay, which is, well, it's still a reasonable amount of time. But I wanted to sort of see, where do you want to go with this? I there are so many trope questions that I can be asking, mm-hmm. Starting with after the Mars trilogy, Wiggling Fingers.
Yeah.
And between the short stories, as it were, what are you working on?
Well, I'm finishing up a novel called Work Done for Hire, which is a pun. It's a large... The title itself is an involute joke, because it's about a writer. It's the only novel I've ever written with a writer as the viewpoint character.
Mm.
And he's involved with doing a work done for hire, which most of your listeners know is a commercial work that the copyright has been assigned to somebody else. It's just pure hack work. And so he's doing that, but he's also been contacted by somebody who won't identify himself, who's trying to hire him to be a sniper, to assassinate someone who has not been identified. And this guy was a sniper in the war, and a good one. But he doesn't want to kill some civilian, no matter how bad that person is. I mean, he says, I'm not a murderer. I was a soldier, but I'm not a murderer. And they're not taking no for an answer.
Mm.
And so they're sort of hounding him to do this job, and the police won't believe him. They think he's doing some sort of a publicity gag because he's a writer, you know. And so I'm having a lot of fun with that.
That sounds it, yeah. Yeah.
So Work Done for Hire is the thing. I've probably only about 15,000 words go on that. So I'll finish that this summer, I hope. And then I've got the tentative title of a novel called Phobos Means Fear. And it's a hard science fiction near future novel about the exploration of Phobos, preparatory to the first Mars landing. And here I'm just really diving off into midair without with my fingers crossed, because we don't know exactly how Mars exploration is going to go, what the timing of everything will be. The physics of it, which is tied to the money of it, would indicate that the first thing you want to do is get a base on Phobos and not go in and out and in and out of the Martian gravity well over and over, especially if they can set up a, and this is where my fingers are really crossed, I'm hoping they can set up an automated machine on the Martian surface that will make oxygen and hydrogen.
Yes.
Because that's what you need. And once that thing is going, then they can just, you know, futz around on Phobos and get things set up to go down to Mars once there is rocket fuel being generated on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And then that could work. Or even a space elevator, the way that people have thought about it. I'm not sure which way I'm going to go on that. But the whole idea is to make a really dramatic story that's consistent with near future planning in actual space science. Because I'm sort of going back to my roots and writing a good hard SF novel.
Yeah.
Although it's got a weird kink in it, which I shall not reveal.
Yet.
Yeah. And I'm all excited on that. And I've got to do more research about Mars and about Phobos.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite possible that the first probe to actually land on Phobos will land there about the time my book's coming out.
Ooh.
Yeah, that wasn't on... Yeah, that's not why I chose Phobos. But, wow, what a great coincidence that it'd be.
Yes, exactly. How do you know? Everybody will be asking, how did you arrange that?
Yeah, right. How did I... managed to...
Which friends of Soviets, yours in Florida.
Yeah, and I actually managed to get the Soviets to screw up their... I mean, the Russians to screw up their Phobos flight.
Yeah. Well, I think the odds on that were good, but...
Yeah, really. Mars is such a an unforgiving target. Almost, you know, what is it? 90% of the probes launched to Mars have had trouble or lost, or whatever.
But it's such a romantic target for
and
people.
It's such a such an attractive next step for space industrialization. Mm. You know, it's the obvious place to go.
Yeah. There are many who say it always was.
Yeah.
So.
This image of Carl Sagan sitting in the tree outside his window looking up at Mars in the sky and saying, I have to go there, you know.
Yeah. And, but romantically, it's been brought back occasionally. Even though they dropped the title from the movie John Carter.
Yeah, how could they do that?
Oh, the marketing of that movie.
That was such a disaster.
What did you think of the movie?
I thought it was good.
I thought it was good, too.
I mean, that's the kind of movie I wanted in 1970 or something.
Yeah, exactly. I cannot... Well, it was a movie that was about 100 years in the making.
Yeah, really.
But first major attempt, I think it was about 1936 or so by Bob Clampett. But I thought it was a good movie. I liked it. I haven't found anybody who said it was a bad movie.
Yeah.
But the marketing...
It's badly marketed.
It was miserably marketed. So it's Disney, and they take out the word... Well, first thing is that it was going to be Pixar.
Yeah.
And then, which it really was. It was sort of Pixar's first live-action film. And then they say, well, no, it's too different. We'll move it to Disney. So Princess of Mars, and then Disney says, well, it's Disney, and it's got the word princess.
Yeah.
So, you know, Princess and the Frog didn't do well, and the boys won't go.
Yeah.
And then, well, it's John Carter of Mars, and, oh, well, Mars needs moms bombed.
Right.
And also Mars, so girls won't go.
Yeah.
And so they saw to it that nobody would go.
Right. Boy, they really blew that one.
Yeah, a shame, because it wasn't bad, and I wouldn't mind seeing the sequels.
Yeah, that would be great. Ah, well.
Yeah, to do Burroughs
it's still,
properly.
It made about, $250 million, didn't it? So that's not a failure.
Well, they're claiming it lost $200 million. But how they can claim that when it hasn't hit the foreign markets and the DVDs aren't out, I don't know. Yeah. When the day is, when that movie is finally done for and is in its eighth, by the time it goes to free syndication or whatever, in whatever universe it will be, they will not have lost money.
Yeah.
But it probably doesn't look good in their stock reports.
Yeah. Well, it's a pity for those of us who write science fiction, because we would love to have that be a huge success to make the studios hungry for more sci-fi.
Yeah, but I hate to harp on this, and you've got a large body of work that could be dramatized.
Yeah.
But very clearly, one takes a look at certain films, I guess largely the body of work by James Cameron, thinking more of Aliens than of Avatar, but also Avatar, and you're saying, okay, look, they can do that. They can do Forever War.
They can do anything.
Yeah, they really could, and they could do it well at this point.
Yeah. That's the thing. There was a turning point, and I hesitate to give it an actual year, but decade by decade, I'd say sometime around 1990 to 2000, it became technologically trivial to do any hard SF novel as a realistic movie.
Yeah.
They can do anything with special effects. And by this decade, the special effects cost so little.
Yeah.
That it's not an argument against any story which would have been a good argument, say, in 1980 or even 1990. Say, well, we could do that, but it would cost $1 trillion.
Yeah. Well, I thought John Carter was another turning point, because the special effects in that, people weren't looking at that and saying, wow, what great special effects. But may I say, wow, what great special effects, because you weren't thinking about
them. Right. It's seamless. It's just a movie.
You were just watching the movie, and the fact that you were doing that instead of saying, gosh, wow.
Yeah, you compare that, for instance, well, a good instance is, compare that to Starship Troopers, the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there you're absolutely grabbed by the throat and say, this is an alien, man. This is a bug. You're going to believe this one.
Yeah. Which of your other works would you like to see dramatized?
You know, on the smallest scale, I would love to see the Hemingway hoax done.
Yes. I knew.
You know, just a made-for-TV movie is all you would need. It's not a high-budget thing.
Yeah. You know what I think? Play.
Yeah, play would be good.
A play would be good. Yeah. And there's some very good science fiction theater emerging here and there.
Yeah,
so
that's true. And I've been adopted for the stage and enjoyed it.
Which works?
The Forever War.
Oh, you know, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it had a little run in Chicago. And
I guess we were waiting in New York.
Well, I was in Boston, and I was actually commuting back and forth between Boston and Chicago.
Mm.
What was interesting that I should have forecast, I should have seen, but I didn't. When they started casting for the Forever War, guys were lined up around the block because all the characters are gay. And they're masculine roles that need homosexuals and lesbians for the feminine roles.
Right.
So the word went out in the acting community in Chicago, and every gay actor in the city was lined up around the block to get onto this show. And they did it with great passion. It was just a wonderful production. So, the Organic Theater Company.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're...
Stuart Gordon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did the script, and we rewrote it 7 times and all, and had a good time with it. Great time. I loved meeting the actors and changing the dialogue, you know, in conference with them and the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I was getting distracted there by something else. But yeah, I would very much, I'm sorry that didn't make it to New York. A number of things from Organic did.
Yeah, Bleacher Bones. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that we can do this again before another century or decade or whatever passes. Are you coming to New York anytime?
Oh, I'm always in and out.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's time for you to do a reading for us.
Yeah, I should. I should, yeah. Actually.
Well, we'll talk about that offline. But again, it's been too long. Thanks so much.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with science fiction writer Joe Haldeman, recorded this year on May 30th at about 11 a.m., the morning after the Nebula Award presentations had been given out. And it was, at least for me, I'm talking way too much there, just, you know, it was a chat. And a lot of fun. And yeah, I'll be in touch with Joe about his coming here live and perhaps doing a reading and things like that. And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The show is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and this is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. If, in fact, you would like to join the Facebook group for the radio show, you go to Facebook, and in the search box, you type in Hour of the Wolf, and you'll see two things in there. One is a movie, a fan page for the movie by Ingmar Bergman, and that's always, well, that's a fascinating film. In fact, this radio show is named after it. And the other is the group for this show. I also have another group for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and you can join that as well and be kept up to date. Again, a reminder, this coming Tuesday, September 11th, at 138 Sullivan Street, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at 6:30. Carlos Hernandez and Rick Bowes will be the readers. Admission free, donations accepted. And this is the first reading of our 22nd season. So I hope that you'll be there for that. Now, speaking of the Nebula Awards, the Hugo Awards were just presented this past weekend. And there was a bit of Sturm und Drang involving that. With the Hugo Awards were, as the Nebula Awards, were being webcast. And there's a company called Ustream that provides free webcasting from one to many. And they have a robot. They have a third-party service that looks for copyrighted materials. Because, for example, if you could start a Ustream cast. I could be doing one right now. Actually, I've thought of doing that or a Google Hang or something during this show. And as you are doing that, somebody could just, broadcast a movie, broadcast a concert, something like that. And if, in fact, it's blatantly going against a copyright, it simply cuts it off. Well, during the presentation, the best dramatic presentation the short form and the long form of the Hugo Awards, as they were showing clips, which they've gotten clearance of. I don't know if they've gotten clearance for the internet. Maybe they did, but I don't know. I certainly know that they did get it for the place itself, for the venue itself in Chicago. The robot, the bot watching over the event, saw clips from Doctor Who and various things, Game of Thrones, being sent over the web and just cut it off. And they were not able to get it back on in time. It's a non-science fiction, and it is a science fiction. It's a whole interesting question of what happens with these kinds of things. Not to go into great, great detail, but I will explain. The Hugo Awards are basically a fan award. Anybody who joins the Worldcon is allowed to vote. Approximately 1,100 people voted overall. The novel had maybe 900 people voting for it. The novelette and graphic novel each had about 400 to 500 people. So it's not, by the way, as huge an acclamation as some people think. And in fact, margins can be very tight. 10, 25 people can make the difference between a Hugo or not, which is why I always say, go for the nominees. Where you, you know, if you want to find out what's good, check out the nominee list for a year. And if you want the novels, want to know the best novels, check out both. The Nebula Awards are given out by the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America. It's a peer award. It is, if you, I don't want to make a comparison between, say, the Academy Award and People's Choice Awards, but one is a peer award and one is a fan award. Then there is the World Fantasy Award, but while that deals strictly with fantasy, it's also a different beastie because that is a juried award. A panel of people get together and give them out. So there were a number of things that coincided, among others, by Jo Walton, that's J.O. Walton, that's a woman, won the best novel in both the Nebula and the Hugo. The novella for the Hugo Award, again, coincided, was The Man Who Bridged the Mist. The novelette for the Nebula Award was written by Jeff Ryman and, by the way, broadcast on this show with Jeff reading it, called What We Found. The novelette for the Hugo Award instead was 6 Months, 3 Days by Charlie Jane Anders, a segment of which was broadcast on this show, actually. The Jeff Ryman was taken from the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series, and the Charlie Jane Anders was taken from the New York Review of Science Fiction. Best short story was The Paper Menagerie by Ken Liu in the Nebula Awards and the Hugo Awards, excuse me. And in the Nebula Awards, I have to go to different sources here. Same story. So there actually was a great deal of crossover. The Ray Bradbury Award for dramatic presentation. The short form in the Hugo Award, they give out two. The short form was The Doctor's Wife, written by Neil Gaiman, was Doctor Who. They were all over Doctor Who in both cases. And in the long form, they gave it to Game of Thrones. And here I have an issue. Simply, well, Doctor Who has an arc on a per-season basis, generally. Especially if you take a look at the fifth season, the first Matt Smith season, has a beginning, middle, and end. It introduces the character, it has complete closure. If you watch that and that alone, you're going to get a complete story. Same is true, even less so, of Game of Thrones, right? So how is that long form? Either Doctor Who should be eligible as long form, or Game of Thrones should be restricted to short form. So I have an issue with that. But again, the Hugos is a complicated thing. I'm pleased to say, by the way, the Campbell Award for Best New Writer went to a young lady named E. Lily Yu, who I also interviewed at the Nebula Awards. She was nominated for both. And, oh my God, is she a wonderful writer. And she's this young age. I mean, she looks like she's about, 15 years old, but except that she's got her doctorate at this point, and I couldn't get her into New York. She was actually living in Jersey, not that far away, but couldn't make it to New York because, like, the day after she graduated, she began being a professor on the West Coast. But her writing is just absolutely wonderful. She wrote this short story, The Cartographer Wasps and the Anarchist Bees, that was published in Clark's World, which is an online zine edited by Neil Clark. And we did an interview with her, and we are going to broadcast that soon. By the way, another nominee for short story was, at least for the Nebula, was Mama, We Are Xenia, Your Son, by Tom Crosshill, which he read live on this program. So, no, recorded on this program. I even broadcast it that evening. That's right. Tom lives in Latvia at this point, went from New York to Latvia, but does tune into this program by virtue of internet-y kinds of technologies. If we have like 10 minutes before Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Ahmad Ali, special, is it guest host or host guest? I'm not sure which it is. It could be...
I would say just a fill-in.
Oh, okay. A fill-in is something you put in a tooth. You're deriving the material, correct?
Yes.
So, okay, so you're the guest programmer.
Guest producer, exactly.
Yeah. But we have a few minutes before Ahmad comes in with that wonderful show. And if you'd like to call up and discuss what you've heard this morning, or science fiction and fantasy and related knickknacks in general, feel free to do so at 212-209-2900. And, blah, 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 if I can do this. Good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The Cartographer Wasps and the Anarchist Bees. It sounds like a wild New Age fable.
Yes, although Robert, you would have been in awe.
Why?
Of what occurred. I had been interviewing this incredible young adult writer, Franny Billingsley. And I'm the only person in the world who is not familiar with Franny's work. I was interviewing people in a machine in these half-hour bursts. I had a total of originally 42 people to interview in those 4 days. I ended up doing about 20, 25 or so, and James Gates, who's the PR director of CEFWA, managed the others by farming them out to different people. And when Franny was segueing to Lily, the one thing that I was doing, I am creating an epic, what I'm calling a B-roll, where anytime I do an interview now, off air or whatever, I ask the person the stupidest question ever for science fiction writers, which is, where do you science fiction writers get your crazy ideas? Which is supposed to be a snarky question and should get a snarky, stupid answer. But a few people answered honestly. And Franny Billingsley said two words, Scottish ballads.
Wow.
And the moment she said that, Lily Yu, this, again, young Asian woman from Jersey. That's how Asian she is. She's from Jersey.
Not the Isle of Jersey.
Just with a voice like an angel, started some version of, I don't even remember which child ballad. Ooh. I have this all on recording, and just started singing it in this beautiful tone. And Franny was saying, where did you get that music from? And Lily said, well, I'm from the Pine Barrens. This is how it's been handed down through all the years. And then Franny began the Scottish version. And then they were say, and I had my computer with me, so I played them the Appalachian version. And we were all discussing Tamlin for a while. I played the Bill Jones version of Tamlin. So anyhow, you would have had an orgasm on the spot,
yeah,
Robert.
Yeah. Now, you asked about last week. I think on the whole it went well, but I think what augmented it was the very story. I must tell you, I was sitting here rooted to the sitting on the bed, listening to the radio, and a station was coming in and out a little bit, but I was absolutely raptured by the concept of that particular story. And what I thought about, and it's not really the same thing, but what flashed through my mind was Michael Moorcock's Behold the Man,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of another take on the Christ story.
Well, you know, any number of writers, including Ray Bradbury, have all done not just Christian, but Christ-like fables.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there was...
And there's more than one anthology.
Oh, yeah, at least two or three that they're totally devoted. I wanted to ask you, by the way, a Doctor Who question. Since you are a Whovian par excellence, I was doing some research on a totally different topic having to do with railroads, and I came across an item on Google or some search thing through a friend that said that Doctor Who had an episode involving the Orient Express. And I was wondering if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
Oh.
Next question.
Well, all right.
I mean, you know, a TV show that's been broadcast since 1963. It began broadcasting... 2 days, oh no, the day after Kennedy was shot.
Really?
So a lot of people missed the premiere for just that reason. But that's the day that the series began. And outside of a period, it was canceled in, 1986, came back in 1995 for a really poor movie, and then came back in 2005 to greater success than ever. We're up to the 50th anniversary is next year.
Wow.
It is something like the 38th or 39th season of the series. People say we're now into the seventh season. No, the seventh season of the reboot.
Yeah.
But it's been rebooted. 39. We're on the 11th Doctor.
Wow.
Yes. It's been rebooted 11 times.
11th or 12th?
11. 11. Ah, we're okay. On the 11th Doctor.
I see. Now, I do have...
That one. Much I know about.
No. Well, you know a lot more, believe me.
By the way, we only have seconds left.
Tell me again the woman's name of the Pine Barrens, Franny Billingsley?
No.
Oh,
no,
the other
one. She's Scottish. Lily Wu.
Lily Wu. Well, I hope we'll talk more about the Pine Barrens.
I'm sorry. Why you?
No, you.
Okay. No, you.
Okay.
Who? No, that's the doctor.
Yes,
anyway.
Yes. Anyway, we'll see you next
anyhow, time. Who? Okay, between them, who's on first?
What's on second?
You's on, know. No, you's on second. Anyway, okay, I better get off.
See you Tuesday.
Okay. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for putting up with me and listening. Stay tuned, as mentioned, for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Ahmad Ali, filling in for the either vacationing or otherwise just errant Lister, who hopefully will be back fairly soon. See if he can get back before we start another fundraising drive and we're all constantly preempted again. And outside of that, enjoy your week. Yeah, you should come Tuesday also. You should come on Tuesday to the New York Review of Science Fiction readings at 138 Sullivan Street. We open at 6:30. Admission is free. And, it's just going to be a lot of fun. Now, why isn't my theme playing? Okay. Because I single-clicked and not double-clicked. Okay, well, we'll all click upon ourselves. We'll join our click. That is WBAI. And stay tuned.
in a van back. It in a your handbag, your knapsack, it in a your backpack. The smell of your girlfriend contact. Some boy not know this. Them only come around like tourists on the beach with a few club sodas. Bedtime stories and pose like them named Chuck Norris. And don't know the real hardcore, cause sandals are no back to. He talks them with the way them got to. And won't think twice to shot to. Don't make them spot to. Unless you carry guns a lot to. A beer tough thing come at you. When trench town man stop laugh and block off traffic. Then them wheel and pop off and them start trap it. With the pin file long and it happy trap it. Police come in a jeep and them can't stop it. Some say them a playboy rabbit. Get dropped like a bad habit. Son of a bother post off if you don't have it. Rastafari stands alone. Welcome to Jack Rock. Hey. Welcome to Jack Rock.
Out in the street, they call it murder.
Welcome to Jam Down, where people are dead at random. Political violence can't done. Pure ghosts and phantom. The youth them get blind by stardom. Now the king of kings are called. Old man to pick me. So wave on no one if you with me. To see this operation sick me. Them suit not fit me. To win election them trick with them. Them down to nothing at all. Come on let's face it. A ghetto education's basic. And most of the youth them waste it. And when them waste it, that's when them take the guns, replace it. Then them don't stand a chance at all. And that's why enough little youth have up some fatmatic. With the extra magazine in a them back pocket. And a bleach at night time in a some black jacket. All who not lock Glock said them a lock rocket. Them a pull you up a current like a shock socket. Them a run a road block which but the cops block it. And from now till a morning no stop clock it. If them run out a rounds a broke back ratchet. Southside, Northside.
Welcome to Jack Rock.
East Coast, West Coast. Yo.
Welcome to Jack Rock.
Cornwall, Middlesex and Surrey, y'all. Hey.
Welcome to Jack Rock. Out in the street, they call it murder.
Jamaica, Jamaica. Jamaica, Jamaica. Jamaica.
Listening to WBAI, New York.
Thank you. What's that called?
Three Views of a Secret.
Nice.
The Gil Goldstein story in music is basically, you know, a long shot. You know, I grew up playing accordion as a kid. It was pretty much the only thing I ever really learned how to do, music. I was a terrible student and kind of, you know, it was totally a self-discovery for me. My parents said that as a kid, I just said music, music, music. And it was one of those things that as soon as I got an instrument, I kind of understood it. You know, I had perfect pitch and I kind of went, I know this is my thing, my language.
Nobody else in the family?
Nobody. My dad was kind of a very bad, like, kind of harmonica player, and, you know, my mom actually loved singing, and she had a jazz club before my brother and I were born. To a previous marriage, she had a jazz club in Washington, D.C. called the Benghazi, and she had people like, you know, Ben Webster and Pearl Bailey. So, you know, maybe subliminally, it's through her connection. My dad didn't know much about music. And I just, you know, slowly, you know, tried to discover music, you know, because as we know, people get exposed to pretty bad music. Mm-hmm. You know, your chance of getting exposed to really great music is a little slim unless if you're just subject to the media. And my first music was like Lawrence Welk. But I kind of like said, I understand this. Maybe there's something a little further. And then, you know, my parents would buy like classical music. And my mom started buying me like jazz records, you know. I took all kind of lessons with you. The local accordion teacher and the this and the that, you know, and suffered through school terribly because I was kind of the guy that didn't read so good and kind of was an improviser, and all the my teachers kind of didn't like me and I didn't like them. But slowly I kept at it and went to a lot of colleges and kind of eked out this. I really feel like luck is the basis of most of it because, you know, I would have some really bad teachers and then some really good teachers, you know. I flunked piano my first semester at the University of Maryland because I was trying to study classical piano just to get some technique stuff. And then, you know, I flunked and the head of the program called me and said, well, you know, we don't understand why you're studying piano. I said, well, I'm kind of a jazz guy and I want to. And he said, oh, okay, well, play me something. And then he kind of recognized something. He said, well, I can take you on as a student, but you're never going to be a classical pianist. I said, I know, I don't want to be. But he gave me kind of the tool. So I had some people that kind of saved me from, they didn't say, look, get out of here, beat it. And then I had other people who should have been supportive and that seemed like, no, this is, I want you to fit into this mold of something. So I kind of could use school to get what I felt I needed. I was kind of lucky. Like that, just in my kind of tenacity that I said, I'm not going to be this, but I'm not going to discard the whole learning thing because I don't want to be that. I want to learn what I want from the system and kind of use it. You know, I think most of my, again, I feel very lucky to have met a lot of people in my search, either in schools or very close to schools, that were like, now this is inspiring to me and this I can play with this person and they're definitely picking me up to a higher level. And most of that came from the University of Miami. I went there and Pat Metheny was a student. Jaco Pastorius was a person in Florida at the time and it was a real musical culture. And I went, wow, you know, that's the first time I saw people of my generation that I thought, hey, I have a good generation. You know, I have some. I knew them all very well. And I, you know, I'm still very much work with and in touch. Pat and I are very good friends and we, you know, still work and collaborate. Pat was probably the first one that really changed my outlook. Like, ooh, this is a guy that really has a unique voice and You know, he's really a focus, and Jocko. And then, you know, there was people that were in my generation that I always considered a little older than me, like the Brecker brothers, because they had come to New York and were very successful, but they were pretty much my age, you know. But they seemed like so much more developed by the time I was kind of getting ready to come to New York. And then I slowly started meeting those guys, like, very sheepishly, you know, like, hi, you know. And they would be, like, always very kind to me, like, oh, yeah, I heard, you know, you're playing good. And they, and eventually I got to work with both of them very closely, you know. So, you know, I feel that's, to me, always my most amazing thing in music, where, like, you know, you're really not developed enough to work with certain people, and then 10 years later you're kind of are, you know, and like now we're colleagues, and they kind of look to you like as a colleague, and I go like, wow, you know, that's weird, you know, that it kind of, you kind of can catch up in some kind of way, you know. I prepare myself and now I'm kind of, you know, you're kind of there, you know, and you go, really? I'm kind of with them now, and we're on the same kind of level. I'm still learning, and they're still learning, but we're kind of learning together. I hate to admit it, but a lot of times now I don't put as much time into my piano and accordion as I should, but I feel that they're at a certain level.